Hello, and welcome to State of the Revolution. The political revolution gathering across the country today is led from the grassroots up, powered by people from across the political spectrum, organized by our common values, goals, and circumstances. The revolution is a movement, beholden to no political party, organized to find, understand, and use the tools available to change the world, modifying or building new tools as necessary. Our election system is a tool, designed by wealthy white men who owned land, kept slaves, and feared democracy, designed to ensure perpetual rule by the tiny minority of people just like them. For centuries, our forebears have fought, bled, and died to expand the vote to black, female, and poor people. They left us a tool better than the one they found. It's our turn. On November 6th, we're headed to the polls for one of the most consequential elections in recent memory. On the ballot are two proposals for reforming our election system. Proposal 2 amends the Michigan Constitution to take redistricting out of the hands of partisan politicians and establishes a nonpartisan redistricting commission to prevent gerrymandering. Proposition 3 amends the Michigan Constitution to provide automatic voter registration, same-day voter registration, and the unconditional right to an absentee ballot, among several other election integrity provisions. Today on State of the Revolution, my guests are Walt Sorg, co-founder of Voters Not Politicians, and Steve Monte, a progressive activist based in Lansing. So we want to talk about what gerrymandering is and how Proposition 2 plans to eliminate that. You start us off there, Walt?
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity. Gerrymandering is pretty simple. It is taking district maps and adjusting them to get the results that you want. It's a practice that goes back to the founding of our country. It was actually started by Patrick Henry in Virginia back in 1790-something. Mm-hmm. And he did it because he was trying to get James Monroe out mm-hmm. of the Virginia House of Delegates.
Right.
It didn't work then, but it's worked since then. And with computers and data mining and all the information we've got now, it's pretty easy for the politicians to project exactly what's going to happen in a normal election, block by block, district by district, and by adjusting a few lines, they can change the outcome so that the net result is reinforcing artificially the power of one or the other political party. The reason they do this is to maintain power. It's a power play.
Sure.
And whatever party is in power in a particular state is the party that does it. Maryland right now is gerrymandered by Democrats heavily. Republicans are furious. Mm-hmm. Michigan is the opposite. It's Republicans that have been doing the gerrymandering. Doesn't matter. If any time a party can do it, they will do it. Mm-hmm. Now, we redistrict every 10 years based on
right.
the census.
Sure.
So our next redistricting is going to be in 2021 after we get the 2020 census in. Mm-hmm. And that's what this amendment would impact. It would basically say the politicians, you're done writing your own districts. You know, Ronald mm-hmm. Reagan, in an interview with William Buckley, one of the godfathers of the conservative movement,
sure.
said back in 1990 it's a conflict of interest for legislators to be doing this, to draw their own districts. Mm-hmm. And he was right. We would take it away through this constitutional amendment to a nonpartisan commission that would consist of four representatives each of the two largest political parties in the legislature, which right now, of course, is Republicans and Democrats, but it could be the Whigs and the Tories,
sure.
or the vegetarians and the vegans, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is. And then five who are not aligned, who say they're not aligned with either major political party. Mm-hmm. And they come together, they draw the maps. After public input, we take it out of the back rooms and have a lot of public input into the process. Mm-hmm. And then to adopt the maps, you've got to have consensus. Mm-hmm. At least two Republicans, two Democrats, and two independents on the 13-member mm-hmm. commission have to agree, and then they've got to find their seventh vote somewhere. Mm-hmm. What they found in California, where they've done something very similar, mm-hmm. is that the members of the commission, once they actually start their work, mm-hmm. they forget about their party labels because they're not invested in the system. We don't allow in our amendment hardcore politician, political activists to be a part of the process. Mm-hmm. No legislators, no lobbyists, no mm-hmm. party officials. Mm-hmm. Those types of people cannot be on the commission, nor can members of their immediate family. Mm-hmm. It's regular citizens are doing mm-hmm. the judging of these maps, which are basically going to be designed by consultants that they hire mm-hmm. using state funds. And that's how it's going to work. The experience in California has been very positive in a lot of ways.
So, Steve, I understand that you're coming into this a little bit educated on this. Does that explain a lot of
sure.
a lot of your questions?
I think I get the basic principle of mm-hmm. how gerrymandering can rob people of the representation, because you know, a large demographic supporting one party, for instance, could vote and not receive the proportional representation that they deserve. Because I think it was in Pennsylvania, 2012, they 51% voted Democrats, but they only took 5 out of 18 seats.
Sure. We had the same thing happen in Michigan with our state senate.
So I definitely see that that's the problem. I'm also aware, you know, like you mentioned, California, I think also Alaska, Arizona, Montana, Washington, a couple, 6 or 7 states have already adopted nonpartisan. But I guess what I'm unfamiliar with is more of the, how do we know that this is a step in the right direction, versus it still sounds like to me, from a somewhat layman's point, that the parties still have control. I hear the two major parties, and then the third one is not affiliated with one of those two parties, but it could be the third party. And so I'd like to learn a little bit more about maybe how that problem is addressed to keep this nonpartisan, not just multipartisan. You know what?
Well, to keep it, to say that people are going to be, you can put people on the commission that don't have political views is just, it's not true. Everybody's got some sort of political view. What we've tried to do is to eliminate from the process the people that have the most personal stake in the outcome, which is mm-hmm. the people in the parties, mm-hmm. the lobbyists that are trying to influence legislation. Mm-hmm. And we've made it fairly broad. You cannot serve on the commission if within 6 years of the commission being formed or afterwards, you've run for partisan office. You are a party official, right down to precinct delegate. You're a lobbyist. You're a non-classified employee in the executive branch, a gubernatorial appointee, basically. Military does not count there, by the way, because they are non-classified. Mm-hmm. They're technically in the executive branch. Members of the legislative staffs cannot be mm-hmm. on. So that you have people that are, it's sort of like picking a jury. It's mm-hmm. a jury of your peers. Mm-hmm. That's the concept.
Years.
There's no way to eliminate human biases. Mm-hmm. Now, you said the party control, it's for purposes of identification so that people can say, well, I tend to vote for Democrats, or I tend to vote for Republicans, or I tend to have a mishmash of a ballot, mm-hmm. and I don't adhere to either party. But the direct control of the parties, because of the way the commission is selected, which involves a lot of randomness, mm-hmm. makes it does make it statistically impossible for the parties to rig the system.
And so it would be the Secretary of State that's doing the random selection?
The Secretary of State has a ministerial role. It's sort of like the director of the Lottery Bureau doesn't pick the lottery numbers. The lottery director is responsible for setting up a system so those numbers are randomly drawn. And that's sort of how the Secretary of State functions as well.
So let me ask you this. Like in jury duty and jury selection, there's a process to determine if a juror has bias. So apart from, which I think is great protections of not having party affiliations all the way 6 years back, is there another process after they're selected to make sure that we don't have anybody that's promoting an agenda?
It's a three-step process in terms of the pool that's created. The first pool is consisted of first of the Secretary of State has to send out requests to apply to the commission to at least 10,000 voters at random around the state, and they have to reply and say, "Look, I qualify for it. I swear under oath, I'm not the governor of Michigan or whatever, or I'm not a precinct delegate or whatever." And then also, if you don't make that cut, if you're not that random sample of 10,000, you can apply yourself. All of those names then get sorted into the three buckets, Democrat, Republican, and Independent.
And those are self-identified, right?
They're self-identified. There's no other way to do it, but okay. It is under oath.
Okay.
And there is a check further on in the process.
So when you say under oath, then the backstop to that is penalty of perjury.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so now you've got this huge pool, three huge buckets of people. Mm-hmm. Out of that, the Secretary of State draws at random 60 Republicans, 60 Democrats, and 80 Independents. So now you got 200. Mm-hmm. Of those 200, each of the four legislative leaders can have what we call a peremptory challenge. They can knock 5 people off the list.
So clarify for people, legislative leaders, you mean the majority leader and the minority leader of the state House and state
Correct.
Senate?
Yeah, the Speaker
okay.
of the House, the majority leader of the Senate,
sure.
and the two minority leaders. They can each sure. knock 5 people off. What will happen practically is once that list of 200 is made public, and it's all mm-hmm. going to be public, by the way.
Sure.
First of all, their neighbors will be able to squeal on them if they cheated. Mm-hmm. You know, if I put it in there and I say, well, I'm a libertarian or whatever, mm-hmm. I'm an independent, and they say, well, no, he's a Democrat. Mm-hmm. He's lying. Okay. But also, they'll run it through databases because mm-hmm. they can tell pretty much who you are just by looking you up. Mm-hmm. And so they'll be able to take the real ringers off there. There's also a second fail-safe. The commission itself, once it's selected from the remaining people from that pool of 200, it's mm-hmm. again, it's random draws. Mm-hmm. So you can see it'd be impossible for the parties to rig it because right. of the numbers involved.
Well, so what they can do is they can take people out of the pool from which the 13 will be drawn at random.
And they'll be drawn at random. Then they'll take four out of one hat, five out of the second hat, and four out of the third hat, right. and that's your commission.
And the members, that ratio is specified?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's also, the Secretary of State is mandated to statistically modify the sample, of the big sample, so that all portions of the state are represented. So it is truly a representative pool mm-hmm. in the initial pool. Mm-hmm. The commission itself can boot one of its members for nonfeasance, for whatever reason they want. They can just say this person is not doing the job, they're not up to doing the job, or whatever.
Ten of the 13 need to agree that one of the other,
yeah,
one of the others is
loser, yeah. out.
Right. So one of the objections that's been raised actually is that there's no way for voters to hold the commission accountable. The commission basically has to hold itself accountable. There's no there's no way for any outside body to say, hey, these people are not behaving properly or something like that.
There's no accountability now, really.
No, that's true.
It is at some point in the process to build accountability, and you build in more checks, and you build in more potential biases. And we struggled with this for a long time mm-hmm. on how to select the commission and how to, California's got a system, they've got the nonpartisan auditor general mm-hmm. does a screen. Mm-hmm. We don't have any nonpartisan officials in Michigan, mm-hmm. really.
Right.
The courts say they are, but they're not.
Right.
So we struggled with that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's going to really help, too, is the process is completely transparent. Mm-hmm. Every aspect of this process is mm-hmm. public. There is no secrecy involved, mm-hmm. which is 180 degrees from what we've got now. Everything's done in secret now. Mm-hmm. In 2011, when they drew our current maps in Michigan, mm-hmm. the final version of the bill, which mm-hmm. was a complete substitute, mm-hmm. was introduced 10 minutes before it passed.
Right. 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 Right.
With no discussion.
Right.
Plenty of time for due diligence there.
Oh, yeah. They had a public hearing during minute three.
Really?
Bing, bang, boom, it passed in a party line vote, went to the Senate, they concurred in the amendments the next day, and off it went to the governor.
So just to play devil's advocate, one thing that comes to my mind is why not make the pool that's being randomly selected 100% picked from one pool versus having the ability to volunteer for this? I just don't think that there's a need to allow people to say, I want to serve on this, because that opens up a little door, however small it may be, to somebody intentionally pushing an agenda. And when we know that there's billions of dollars spent in elections, it's not completely unrealistic in my mind for a candidate to say, I'm going to hire 2,000 people to all volunteer, and that's going to represent 10% of this random pool, and that should guarantee me hopefully one seat, maybe two seats. But that's a way for money to influence this process. And I understand that there's checks to hopefully prevent that or prosecute under perjury.
Right.
But I feel like that's maybe opening the door unnecessarily by allowing volunteer involvement. I'm sure there's a better reason that I can't think of for that, though.
Well, quite as a lot of what you see in the proposal is the direct result of the way we drafted it, which was we went out first and said, look, these are the principles we want to adhere to. Independence, transparency, mm-hmm. fairness, lack of partisan bias. Mm-hmm. And then we had town halls all over the state. We asked people, what are some of the ways we can do this? And what we ended up with is really a representation of what we heard mm-hmm. from around the state. And that's part of it. Also, you point out, it is possible to have one or two ringers on a commission, but with 13 members and requiring tripartite consensus on a map, the one or two bad apples can't mess up the process.
So actually, let me point a little bit more detail on what the in order for any plan to for the commission to agree on any plan. Tell me if I get this wrong, but you have to have two members of the commission from each of the three different buckets agree to it, plus someone else.
Plus one more.
Plus one more. So there's some Republicans, some Democrats, or whoever the two major parties in the state legislature are at the time, and then you need two of the ones that are not aligned with one of the two major parties. So you have to have six, two, and two from the three different buckets agree, plus another one from somewhere. So that makes it much more difficult that even if somebody were to get one or two ringers on, that they wouldn't be able to
tremendously hard,
you know, to control the
That'd sort of be like rigging. I think we got $1 billion at stake in the mega draw mm-hmm. right now. That would be trying to figure out how to rig that, which I'd love to do, by the way.
Well, to further on my advocacy for the devil, mm-hmm. It's been shown in juries that one planted juror that says, mm-hmm. I think I recall seeing a red jacket, can transfer their false recollections to other jurors, and then those jurors will believe that they also saw that red jacket. So that's mm-hmm. that's a noted phenomenon.
Jurors deliberate in private. The commission will not.
Yeah. That's the key thing, is that it's all public.
Fact-checked.
Right. And the other thing is that there's lots of public meetings required where input from the public is required.
Yeah, they found in California that the webcasts of mm-hmm. their hearings were killed in the soaps mm-hmm. in the afternoon. They were so popular. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is people did try to load up the hearings mm-hmm. in California, and we met with several of the commissioners mm-hmm. Who came to Michigan to tell us about their experience. We had, mm-hmm. I think it was two Republicans, an independent, a Democrat came mm-hmm. in. And they said that it was easy for them, in their minds, they're kind of pissed off by the ringers that came in to testify, mm-hmm. and they completely disregarded it. Mm-hmm. The other thing, you were asking about accountability, too. There are two checks mm-hmm. still on the commission's work, mm-hmm. and that's the state and the federal courts. Mm-hmm. The state Supreme Court can review mm-hmm. the maps to make sure that they comply with the constitutional standards. There are standards for what they've got to do with the maps, mm-hmm. Including not showing any favoritism for one political party or candidate,
right.
among other things, but also contiguous, avoid breaking up cities, townships, and counties, communities of interest mm-hmm. being united to the best extent possible. Mm-hmm. So the Supreme Court of Michigan can review that, and if they don't like what they see, they mm-hmm. send it back to the commission. Mm-hmm. They can't write their own map. You can also go to the federal court if they decide mm-hmm. that there's a voting rights violation in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me ask you a question just popped in my head about that. So, if the census comes out and the committee begins its deliberations, comes up with something that's then challenged by the Supreme Court, and this starts taking a while and time starts going on, is it possible that if an election occurred in the meantime, it would have to result to at-large candidates or the previously set districts? Or how would that work if there's the possibility for kind of a quote-unquote filibuster?
That's always been a challenge, and it's never happened, because mm-hmm. Every 10 years there's been lawsuits about mm-hmm. the maps that the legislature passed, or if they couldn't pass one, mm-hmm. it went directly to the courts, and we've never had that issue. As a kid growing up in Illinois, we actually had that happen, mm-hmm. where we ended up everybody ran at large, mm-hmm. as a result in an election, and we ended up with 2/3 of one party winning. The slates were headed by Adlai Stevenson IV, son of the presidential candidate, mm-hmm. on one side, and Earl Eisenhower, Dwight's brother, mm-hmm. on the other. Is hilarious. Mm-hmm. It's good for a kid to watch growing up. Mm-hmm. But this court has shown itself, and we've been to the Supreme Court once already and mm-hmm. won, but it's shown it's sensitive to issues like that and recognizes the reality of having to get things done in time so the clerks can get the ballots printed and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned communities of interest, which is one of the objections that that some of the opponents have raised. That this term is undefined, but it's part of the requirements that the commission has to consider communities of interest. But there's no clear definition of it within the law, even though there are some uses of it in common practice. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about that and how
sure.
that?
First of all, that standard's in the law for 26 states. Mm-hmm. Michigan right. is not unique there. California's got it as well.
Right.
Communities of interest. What is a community of interest will be defined in the public hearings. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example of how it might impact it right here in the 8th congressional district, right here in Lansing. Mm-hmm. our community, I think it would be fair to say that our greater Lansing area is DeWitt to the north and Grand Ledge and Waverly to the west, mm-hmm. down to Jackson. That's kind of like Lansing.
Okay.
What I just described to you are in three different congressional districts right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make sense. Our district runs from Waverly Road on the west side of Lansing damn near to Canada,
mm-hmm.
Going down I-96 and carefully bypassing
right.
Pontiac.
Right.
So that gives the Republicans an advantage there.
Right.
Our community of interest would probably, for a congressional district, which of course is very large, mm-hmm. would go up and down 127.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing I think that you would see change as a result. They would still honor, to the best of their ability, municipal, county, and mm-hmm. township lines, but they would not try to keep communities together. And the people testifying at the public hearings around the state before the maps are drawn mm-hmm. would tell the commission, this is what mm-hmm. we consider our community to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it would, I think it would probably result in better representation for a variety of minority groups.
Mm-hmm.
Not just right now, the only minority group that has special really recognition in the maps is African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And other minorities tend not to get recognized in the drawing of the maps, but that's one kind of community. It's ethnic, it could be religious,
mm-hmm.
it could be socioeconomic, it could be the media market.
Mm-hmm.
And you get Flint, Saginaw, Bay City, I think that's at least two different congressional districts, it might be three.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Things like that. So it is undefined, but it's undefined mm-hmm. on purpose. Mm-hmm. The commission will figure it out based on what they hear from the people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So some of the other, I just want to talk about some of the other objections that are raised, just to be fair. We did look for people opposed to come on, and nobody got back to us. But I want to represent their objections fairly. Some of their objections are, I'm sorry, they're just silly. They're objecting like there's how many words the amendment is. I'm sorry, but...
When in doubt, complain about the length.
Right, exactly.
But the reason it's so long is we want to prevent the legislature from screwing with it.
Sure.
Quite honestly, because if you give the legislature an inch, they'll take a mile.
Right. Well, when we have winner-take-all systems where you can get, one political party that can take complete control of a legislature when, even when they have a minority of the actual voters... obviously that's a big problem, and however many words you need to use to make that stop is the wall to protect democracy.
And by the way, before we leave that point, you mentioned yeah. having one-party control causing the problem.
Yeah.
I worked for the legislature when we had two-party control of this process because we had a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't change much.
Mm-hmm.
It changed the objectives. Most of the maps then are drawn to protect incumbents.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's my main, or not my main, but one of the larger factors I think gerrymandering plays in damaging our democracy is it includes partisanship. Because if you know, and it encourages incumbency wins. So it allows the representatives to not represent their constituents, but represent their party leaders or
donor base.
Donor base, exactly.
No question.
And that's on both sides. Even on the side that's not in control, they still it promotes the status quo. And I think everybody can tell right now that the status quo. Is part of the problem, and so.
Well, just give you an indication of how bad the problem is. There is at least a chance that we're going to have a one-party control flip in this election. It could be Democratic control. Gretchen Whitmer is governor, and Democrats in the House and the Senate. Although the Senate's a lot less likely than the mm-hmm. other two.
Sure.
But if that happens, Gretchen Whitmer still wants to have this commission.
Sure.
Even though she would be able to basically gerrymander Michigan, she doesn't think you should. Which I give her a lot of credit for.
Mm-hmm.
She's very supportive of this proposal, knowing full well that she, for the short term, she may be hurting herself politically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the other things that I was reading through the proposal, there's section 13D. I don't expect you to remember exactly the section.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean.
But it. It says, disproportionate advantage to a political party shall be determined using acceptable measures of partisan fairness. So what kind of acceptable measures are we talking about? So this is when you're talking about the commission comes up with a map, and then you want to test it for partisan fairness. Mm-hmm. There's language in the proposal that there are a number of different tests that you can use, algorithms that you can set up, computer programs that you can do to run scenarios and see how that what kind of ratios you get. The proposal does specifically have language that says all of those, all of the data and all of the and all of the programming language used to run those tests has to be made public,
yes,
so that people can replicate that themselves and see how that comes out. But this acceptable measures of partisan fairness. You're talking about, for example, the efficiency gap. And there are other kinds of measures of fairness, but what determines whether something's acceptable, an acceptable measure? How what kind of measure?
Depends on whether you're asking me in 2021 or 2081.
Okay.
It's going to change.
Sure.
And that's why the language was as it is. It's going to be whatever the state of the art is. It's typically going to go to the number nerds, mm-hmm, of America, and there's lots of them.
Sure.
As a part of this project, a University of Michigan professor ran simulated maps to test the fairness, mm-hmm, of maps, and it's been done in other states as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in Michigan, what they came up with, I think they generated several thousand alternative maps,
mm-hmm,
and found that the one that was actually passed by the legislature was the most partisan.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the thousands of options that were out there, the legislature,
sure,
did a really great job of doing what it was trying to do,
right,
which was skew the map. I just want to give you one number here,
sure,
if I can get my phone up again.
Mm-hmm.
The last midterm election, of course, was 2014.
Mm-hmm.
In the vote for Congress,
mm-hmm,
Democrats got more votes than Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans got 9 seats, Democrats got 5.
Mm-hmm.
In the vote for the Michigan Senate, the Republicans got 50.7% of the vote, Democrats 40.3, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
With that 50.7% of the vote, Republicans got 71% of the seats in the Senate.
You're talking about the state Senate.
State Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And in the state House, Democrats got 51%+ of the votes, Republicans 48, just under 49.
Mm-hmm.
But the Republicans had a majority in the House.
Mm-hmm. And that's entirely due to gerrymandering. Because
absolutely. It's not entirely gerrymandering. Some of it is social gerrymandering,
mm-hmm,
because Democrats tend to congregate in smaller areas. But it's mostly because it was intentional,
mm-hmm,
to make,
sure,
it come out that way.
So one of the questions about this entire process is, why have it be geographically based in the first place? We have local municipalities, we have counties, we have regional authorities such as for watersheds and so on that address local issues like that. Why do we need for the state legislature or for the federal legislature? Why do we need to do this by a geographical system instead of by a system that allows, for example, communities of interest to elect people at large, for example?
It's not something I've even looked at because it wasn't raised in any of our hearings. Nobody raised that suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
Is the short answer. We basically put into this proposal what we heard, based on the feedback we got at these town halls. We did 33, mm-hmm, I think it was, in the month of March of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody suggested that.
No.
From a person,
I'll just say, by the way, I was at one of those, and I actually brought this up to, I can't remember the name of the professor from Wayne State who came and did a presentation.
Kevin Deacon-Krause.
Yes, that's correct. And I raised that with him at that presentation, by the way. So
It's something I've not studied at all.
Okay.
I can't respond to it.
Okay.
I've got my instinctive feeling about it, but my instincts aren't relevant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that I was reading an article about gerrymandering that said you need to address the root problem,
mm-hmm,
which is the fact that there are districts in the first place.
Right.
And as we kind of alluded to earlier, what would happen if the districts weren't drawn, we might have an at-large election.
Mm-hmm.
I think that may be a better solution. However, I think arriving at that point is going to be much more difficult if the politicians who are in place have had this power to choose their voters.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as that's not on the table anymore,
mm-hmm,
of being able to sway the voting population,
mm-hmm,
then our legislators aren't going to be motivated to,
mm-hmm,
have it be that way, so then we can start moving towards something that more equally represents one person, one vote,
mm-hmm,
which would be no districts. You just vote for an at-large candidate, and hopefully they would be campaigning on issues that affect your region,
mm-hmm,
or in general affect you.
Sure. So, the way that the at-large situation would work is that the whole state would be one district, and however many legislators there are. So, for example, if there's 110 members of the state house, then the top 110 vote getters in an at-large election go to the house. Everybody gets one vote. That's how you get one person, one vote, which is actually, according to the Supreme Court, the standard that we're supposed to be following. We're not following that at the moment with the gerrymandering situation that we have. We're going to get closer to it with proposal two, and I certainly support it. But I see it as a step towards greater citizen participation and moving towards an actual a system that actually provides one person, one vote, which is really sorely lacking right now.
I find it interesting that the Supreme Court currently prohibits gerrymandering, right? To the best of my knowledge.
No.
Well,
it's never ruled that way.
Yeah.
I guess I should have referred to the Constitution prohibits gerrymandering, which...
No. There have been court cases that have prohibited maps and have in effect said you can't gerrymander based on race or based on some particular criteria.
Race has been the only criteria that's been upheld in the federal courts consistently.
Right, which is it's actually interesting because it's similar to the way that, you know, we started out as a country. We started out with you had to be white, male, wealthy, and own land to vote.
Yeah.
Okay, 1828, by 1828 we got rid of the need to own land because the wealthy people in the country wanted to have a more liquid system of capitalism. So they were happy to get rid of that. Then we had to fight a war to get rid of, racial bias and
exclusion.
Only
100 years later we did it.
Right. And then of course we had, you know, we didn't stick with it and actually enforce those laws. So we had 100 more years of Jim Crow. And then since the 60s, we still have. Right now we have Secretary of State in Georgia who's running for governor and holding up the voter applications of 53,000 people, 70% of which are African American.
Well, they're screwing with the Native Americans in North Dakota.
And the Native Americans in North Dakota.
Right. You can't vote.
Right. There's lots of different ways. There's all sorts of reports. Voter suppression could take many forms, and we're addressing one form of voter suppression is gerrymandering.
Right.
Proposal 3, the promote the vote, addresses other forms of voter suppression. I just saw a study from Northern Illinois University that was released yesterday that ranked the states on ease of voting.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan ranked 46th, I think.
Yeah.
Oregon was number one. Oregon has mail elections by mail, automatic registration, and they've got the highest voter participation in the country as a result, and no indications of fraud.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, voting by mail makes it harder for the Russians to mess with us.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it paper ballots are much harder to rig.
Right. Well, it makes vote rigging in general harder that way. Right. And it's interesting. It's interesting how much of the voter suppression shenanigans that you see on the right. I don't see this kind of stuff on the left. I mean, maybe there are some instances of it that I'm not aware of in terms of...
In the primaries it occurs.
Well,
it certainly did in 2016.
Sure.
Well, you've also got the issues with students and messing with them, even though it's illegal. Mm-hmm. They're still forcing students to jump through hoops to vote where they go to college.
Right.
Sure.
Right. But I just a couple of things. It's interesting to me to point out the sequence of this, because we got rid of the landowning requirement very early. We got black folks the right to vote after the Civil War, which was then abrogated and continues to be abrogated even after the Voting Rights Act and recently gutted. Then we had women, and it wasn't until 1964 that we eliminated pool taxes, supposedly, and now we've got all of these sort of, nefarious ways that you bring pool taxes back in by, requiring this kind of ID and that kind of ID that costs money to get, or eliminating the places where you can go and register to vote, which makes it more costly for people and difficult for people.
And if you're homeless, you don't have an address.
Right.
And so you can't vote without an address.
Right. And having one-day elections on a Tuesday in November is a form of voter suppression.
Absolutely.
My dad, who was a Republican activist in Illinois when I was a kid, used to pray for rain.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because it would depress the vote.
Right. Right.
In November, you're more likely to get crummy weather than if you have a one-week voting period.
Right.
You get progressive clerks like we've got here in Lansing, who basically makes it possible to vote for weeks.
Right.
We just passed the signs as we walked into the studio today.
Yep.
Sure. You can vote right now, and the election's out for 3 weeks.
That's right. That's right. Actually, voting in this building.
Yeah. Right underneath us.
One of the things that I wanted to point out is that these things are built into our system of government, and they were built in there deliberately. I mean, like, they didn't want people to vote. And they wanted the people that did get to vote, they wanted their vote to count as little as possible. I'm talking about the founders in terms of how they wrote not just the federal constitution, but the state constitutions as well. Because
and you forget the United States Senate was originally elected by the legislature.
By the legislatures, right. It's only been a little over 104 years. I think 1913 is when that got changed. Even talk about three branches of government with checks and balances, but how many of those branches do you get to vote for? You don't get to vote for the president. That's the Electoral College, right? You don't get to vote for the Supreme Court or any of the federal judiciary. That's the president and the Senate. And as you just pointed out, the Senate was originally selected by state legislatures. What we're addressing now is that you don't really get to vote for your representative to the U.S. House because of gerrymandering. You have politicians and political parties choosing their voters rather than voters choosing their politicians, which is what Proposition 2 is trying to change.
Well, the United States is a constitutional gerrymander. The United States Senate.
Absolutely.
Right now, 17% of the population controls 52 votes in the Senate.
That's right. Absolutely. It's if you do the statistics, for example, if everybody in Michigan had the same representation, had one person, one vote representation in the U.S. Senate, the same representation that, say, Wyomingites have. There are 600,000 people in Wyoming. There are about 10 million of us here in Michigan. If we had the same representation as Wyoming, we'd elect 16 senators in Michigan.
Try being California.
Exactly. If you do the numbers for California, it's 65.
Yeah.
They'd elect 65 senators.
And it's interesting that it's mandated that the states be broken down according to population, but not, or, you know, within the states, all the districts must be according to population, but...
Well, you actually have the same thing in the U.S. House as you do in the Senate. So, for example, again, because small states get at least one representative, which I'm fully in favor of, but we don't then reapportion and increase the size of the House like they used to do up until about 1913. They kept increasing the size of the House to accommodate the fact that we had a growing population. But if you do the numbers right now, for example, if you look at the number of people that elect a U.S. House representative in Wyoming or North Dakota or a lot of these other states, and not just the smallest states, but some of the medium, up to some of the medium-sized ones as well, you compare that with Michigan or with some of the larger states, if you do the same math for the House as you do for the Senate, Michigan should have 16 reps in the U.S. House instead of 14.
Soon to be 13.
Right. So for example, I did a spreadsheet on this a couple of weeks ago using I didn't use the 2010 census data. I used the Census Department's data adjusted to 2016, which is the last date that they had the information for. And if you look at that, you find that there are 34 out of 50 states that are underrepresented in terms of the number of U.S. House reps in their delegation to the House. There are 34 states that are underrepresented by 10% or more, 24 of those by 20% or more, and 3 of them by 30% or more. So we have tremendous underrepresentation of people across the board, whether it's in the Senate, whether it's in the House, whether it's in the Electoral College, because what you get for the Senate and the House is how you get what each state gets for the Electoral College.
Yeah. We like to call ourselves a representative democracy, but we really aren't. Right now, we have a president who lost the popular vote. Mm-hmm. We have a Supreme Court where four of the justices were appointed mm-hmm. by presidents who lost the popular vote mm-hmm. and ratified by senators who represented less than half the country.
Much less than half.
And a House of Representatives that by gerrymandering represents less than the majority represents less than half the country.
That's right.
So right now the minority is controlling all three branches of government. That's not representative democracy.
That's not. And that's the thing that I really think that we have to realize when we talk about things like Proposition 2 and Proposition 3. There are lots of things that, from my perspective, I think we could go a lot farther, and I think that we need to. But this is a really important step in moving from a system that was not designed to be a democracy, and no, for all of those people out there are going to say it's a republic, it wasn't designed to be a republic either. It was designed to be It was designed to be an oligarchy of wealthy white men. And if you look at the statistics on this, it's really quite amazing how successful they have been. And how successful they were in creating a system that produces that result. So, for example, every two years of the last 242 years since the Constitution was ratified, every 2 years we've seated a new legislature at the federal and at each of the state levels. And every single one of those legislatures, 121 election cycles, every single one of them, federal and state, have been not just majorities but supermajorities of wealthy white men. And if you look at, and people will say, well, but we changed a lot of the laws. And if you look at more recently, so here's the statistics from more recently. If you look at just since we've had 50 states, okay, so that's 29 election cycles, we've had 50 states. So 29 times 51, that's 50 state legislatures plus the federal legislature. 29 times 51 is 1,479 legislatures since Hawaii became part of the Union about 59 years ago, well within the living memory of many. Every single one of those legislatures has been a supermajority of wealthy white men. We're talking about well over 100,000 individual elections carried out over the course of 60 years, and every single one of them has produced the same result. And you can't look at that and think that, well, that's just by chance. That's because it's designed that way. And what we have to understand, we talk about, you know, you hear people on the news now talking about, you know, how our democratic institutions are being undermined, our democratic system of government is being undermined. The problem with that is that we get people who want to then defend that system of government as because they say it was a democracy, and it's not. It wasn't designed that way. And it's really important that we think about that when we're looking at these propositions, because these are propositions that are moving us in the direction of democracy.
So how do you eat an elephant? It's one bite at a time.
That's true.
These are two bites. I would also point out, just for the record, our three new legislators, House members from Ingham County, mm-hmm. are not going to be rich white men. Mm-hmm. Three women, one of color,
right.
And I don't think any of them is wealthy. They are poor.
Well, so right, and I think that's great. But are we going to have a majority of people who come into the legislature accustomed to living at or below the median income among their constituencies? I don't think so. I think they're all going to be living above. I'm talking about not all of them. But I'm talking about the majority. Are not experiencing what the majority of their constituents are experiencing.
I would agree with that, but I think that is also shifting in the right direction. Unfortunately, evidenced by all of the U.S. Congressmen, women sleeping in their offices because mm-hmm. they couldn't afford D.C. Apartments.
Sure.
And that so much so that they started trying to implement rules and policies to prevent mm-hmm. seated politicians from sleeping in their offices. And
right.
That's a sign that, A, we don't pay our politicians enough, and that promotes and invites corruption. But it's also a good sign to me that we're moving away from complete oligarchy, so much so that the remaining oligarchs are disgusted that these people would have to sleep in their office just to be able to afford to serve their country in that manner, if that makes sense.
Well, you still got people like Rick Scott, who's poured, $50 million into his campaign for the Senate after mm-hmm. spending huge amounts of money to be governor of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
After ripping off the federal government through Medicare.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'd like to think that hopefully when Prop 2 passes, it's a step more towards, I guess to preface that, you know, we've heard that public opinion affects public policy 0%. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a will get us a couple percentage points. Obviously, the money in politics is the main reason for that mechanic, but gerrymandering allows politicians to disregard their constituents.
So term limits.
Yeah.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think that's term limits is another one of the big steps. But like
it makes money more important because you've got to buy name identification.
Right.
You know, it's funny. My brother was a member of the New Hampshire House of Delegates, and his entire constituency was like 2,500 people. Because they've got they got 400 members of their house, mm-hmm. and it's a tiny little state. Mm-hmm. I ran for county commissioner in a district that was 10 times that large.
Right.
For a lousy county commission district, mm-hmm. a state representative's district typically is going to be 85,000. Mm-hmm. The only way you can get your message out to that many people when you're brand mm-hmm. new mm-hmm. is by spending a boatload of money.
That's right. And when you have term limits, then everybody's brand new, you know, a lot of the time. Right. So, but the other thing is that, like I was talking about before, it used to be that we would raise the number of people in the House of Representatives as our population grew. And we stopped doing that over 100 years ago. When you have one representative who's supposed to be the representative for so many people, it's really hard to have a real relationship with your constituency when you're talking about, for example, in the U.S. House, in larger states, it's well over 700,000 people to a representative, where the Constitution actually says it can't be you can't have any less than 30,000 to one. But that gives you an idea of what kind of a range the founders were thinking of. Not that the founders were democracy, but
sorry to interrupt. A simple mm-hmm. amendment could add a maximum ratio to that. If
exactly.
it says no less than 30,000 to one, no greater than 50,000 to one, or 40,000 right. or 35 or whatever.
Right, right. And people object, well, but then the House would be so gigantic. Well, we're a big country.
I mean, if the ultimate goal is for the representatives to represent their constituency, the larger the constituency, the harder it is to accurately represent them. You've got far more groups. I mean, that seems like basic.
It's a very diverse population.
Right.
You get into a district like the one we live in.
Sure.
What do you do? You're going to piss off people no matter what you do because
right.
it's such a diverse district. You've got 700,000 people, and you're going to have at least half of them ready to shoot you. Mm-hmm.
Then again, the opposite side of that coin is the more people one representative is representing, the more their platform must be geared towards everybody. Whereas mm-hmm. if you only represented a very small group, you could have kind of radical platform that only benefits this small group. And maybe that's what's needed for minorities that are underrepresented. But just saying like the other thing, the more people are in your base, the more your platform has to be what's affecting everybody. And maybe if that was more the case, we would be farther along with climate change and topics that are hard to address at local levels because you're trying to represent the desires of everybody that lives right there. But everybody that lives right there also wants the planet to survive. And so in gauging where you devote your time as a politician and what endeavors you want to embark on, mm-hmm. the larger your constituency base, I do think would make your platform be forced to benefit more people.
A lot of it, I think what it does is forces you to be better at constituent service more than anything else.
Right.
The one-to-one stuff is what really matters. We had a congressman here many, many years ago before you guys were born, my name was Charlie Chamberlain, who'd never accomplished anything in Congress, but his constituent service was killer.
Sure.
And he kept getting elected, and finally when the 18-year-old vote came in, that was the end of him.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only thing that changed it, because he could survive on providing great customer service.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
right.
Debbie Stabenow is a really good example of somebody who's tried to bridge mm-hmm. that divide, because she represents such an incredibly diverse state. And it's a state that was carried by both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders in the presidential primary.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells you something. And she's a hero in the agricultural community because she recognized that even though it wasn't a part of her natural constituency, it was an important part of her constituency.
Mm-hmm.
And she made the effort to reach out to them. And as a result, she gets more of the farm vote than any Democrat in America, probably.
Mm-hmm. Sure. One of my personal friends, Adam Inagro, has went to D.C. to testify twice for Senator Stabenow on the farm bill. And, he's a regular guy, lives in my neighborhood on the east side. And it's nice to see that she actually reaches out to people in the field, in the local aspect of that, too.
When she was a state legislator, she focused on small business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily a winning constituency because it's not that large a group of people, mm-hmm. but she recognized the importance. She tried to cover those gaps, and that angers people too. You get the purists on both sides who say she's too much, she's not enough this or not enough that, mm-hmm. and she's trying to represent as many people as she can, and she'll end up getting probably 60-65% of the vote. She's like Carl Levin, mm-hmm. who did that in Phil Hart before him.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of disagreements, despite the fact that I'm putting up a sign in front of my house, First Avenue. I have a lot of disagreements with her on, medical care, for example. But
deregulating the banks.
Deregulating the banks, right? Because so much of it is still driven by, by money. I mean, that's the other part of it. I think you're right that she does a good job in reaching out to certain constituencies that maybe other that maybe some other statewide politicians don't. But the way that she votes a lot of the time isn't actually in the interests of the majority of her constituents, even the majority of those that are voting for her. But our system is designed to make that necessary for politicians to do that, and so this is one of the reasons that I think there are a lot of good things about Prop 2, and I'm certainly supporting it, and I encourage everybody else to support it as well. But we got to look at it as a first step. We can't like just say, okay, now we fixed it, and everybody go home. So one of the questions that I want to ask of Voters Not Politicians is, let's suppose that this passes, which right now it looks like it's going to. What's the next thing?
We absolutely don't know. We haven't had that discussion.
Okay.
We've talked about having the discussion, mm-hmm. But we've been so focused on this election, we said we'll worry about that November 7th.
Okay.
And move forward. We have structured ourselves in a way so that we do have legs.
Okay.
That we can exist beyond the election. But right now, it's 100% focus mm-hmm. on this issue. Let's not get distracted.
Right. No, I understand that, and that certainly makes sense. I'd like to have you on again after the election, and we can have that discussion in more detail. Because what are some of the numbers, by the way? Because you guys really have done a great job organizing a great number of people across the state.
I take no credit for the organization. We've got a field director who's a high school math teacher. Mm-hmm. Never done anything like this before, and she organized thousands of people across the state. Mm-hmm. We collected with all volunteers 425,000 plus signatures. Mm-hmm. We had over 90% accuracy rate, which is very unusual for petition drives. Mm-hmm. Steve's done some, and he knows that mm-hmm. use page circulators, you're lucky to get 70% good signatures. We mm-hmm. got over 90. Mm-hmm. The amendment we had was basically drafted by volunteers. Mm-hmm. We had one attorney we paid a little bit, but I'm not sure he even made minimum wage mm-hmm. For it, who did the end drafting. Mm-hmm. But it was volunteer driven from the beginning. No payroll until actually after we qualified for the ballot. We had to have full-time staff just because it's the nature of the beast in a state this big. We had no money, quite mm-hmm. honestly. We only spent, to get the 425,000 signatures, as I recall, we only spent about $200,000. Mm-hmm. The pros will tell you that you need at least $2 million to collect that many signatures, mm-hmm. if not $5 million if you're going to buy them all.
I think that's a really good indication of how much support this has, because it really had to be volunteer driven, to do it with that kind of money limitation.
Sure. It was crazy. I knew we had something. I did the first town hall even before we announced the ballot committee. We had a town hall in East Lansing on a beautiful Sunday afternoon in February. It was 60 degrees in February. Mm-hmm. Great golf weather. 600 plus people showed up to the cafeteria, which was cool, but what was amazing was they all stayed for 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And 2 weeks later, I was up in Marquette doing a town hall, and mm-hmm. then in Alpena, and mm-hmm. wherever I went, I've been working in politics for a long, long time. This is the first time I had something where I was getting no pushback. Mm-hmm. People were saying, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, right.
And nobody was saying, no, no, no.
And Democrats and Republicans, what is it? I can't think of his name now, but there's a Republican legislator.
Joe Schwartz, former congressman,
that's
on the
one.
Board.
Yeah.
I'm going to a fundraiser tomorrow morning with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Sure.
Who's coming in and helping us.
Is that MSU?
That's going to be over in East Lansing. $100 gets you in the door, Steve. Got a deal for you. and he's going to do a free rally after right. that in downtown East Lansing, right in the middle of the construction. Mm-hmm. Governor Reagan, President Reagan, actually talked about this in 1990.
Yeah, you mentioned that before.
But we've had, he's not the only one at that level. Sure. Of course, Barack Obama is very sure. strong on it, but also Bob Dole, mm-hmm. presidential candidate, John mm-hmm. McCain, presidential candidate, mm-hmm. John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, mm-hmm. The governor of Maryland, whose name escapes me at the moment, I think it's Larry Hogan. Mm-hmm. Of course, he's doing it because he's a Republican governor in a state that's totally gerrymandered right. for the Democrats.
Right.
But that's a great argument.
Right, but
both parties do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that's a knock on him because, you know, I'll tell you, I had in public meetings on this, I had some Democratic elected officials saying, you know, we don't want to like, you know, we don't want Democratic elected officials to get behind this because then they'll all say it's partisan. Well, the fact of the matter is that the people that are going to oppose it are going to say it's partisan anyway, whether that's in...
It's about power, and whoever's got the power is going to fight it, wherever, depending on the state.
That's right.
And that's just the reality of it. We knew the Republicans were going to mount some, although they really haven't mounted much of a campaign.
Well, it's a hard thing to argue with, especially with talking points. Like, voters don't need to decide, or how are you going to spin that and get people behind it?
Well, it's jujitsu, because the more they throw at us, the more we say, well, see, that's the problem.
Right.
Sure.
Right.
I think also, as Liano alluded to, it's about changing or bringing back the idea that our representatives serve the people, and they have stopped doing that.
Right.
And so anyone, when they grasp this, that the politicians are choosing who gets to vote for them, that goes against your fundamental view as an American, not just a Republican or a Democrat.
I'd argue with that a little bit, because they actually do represent their districts. The problem is they get to decide what their district looks like.
Well, at times they go against representing their district.
If there's people in their district that their community was divided in half so that they couldn't win, then they still are within that representative's district, but they have been robbed of their power.
Sure.
What you said there makes sense if you think of a district as a geographic region instead of a group of people. If you think of a district as a group of people, then they absolutely don't represent their districts because they're favoring the group of people that they've engineered to be the majority.
They're representing the majority in their district,
right?
Generally speaking.
Right. Right.
But they've engineered the majority mm-hmm. so that it's to their liking.
Right. And let's be clear. This is one thing that I think that I think a lot of people don't recognize. Majoritarianism is not democratic. Majoritarianism is just sort of the last grasping claw of authoritarianism. It uses the majority as the authority, as opposed to a system of proportional representation where any constituency of significant size has some kind of representation in the legislature that has actual voting power. And that's one of the reasons that, for example, I, again, as much as I'm supporting Prop 2, and I think it's a great step, and we need to take it, moving forward after that is we need to do more so that we're not stuck in this majoritarian system that fundamentally says, well, if you're 49.9%, you don't get any say at all.
Well, ranked choice voting is the obvious path, in my opinion, to take next. If you really want to get away from majoritarian rule, ranked choice voting. It doesn't solve every problem, mm-hmm. but it's the next step in the progression.
It's also the attitude of the people sure. that are running the system. When I worked for the legislature back in the dark ages, I worked for a man who probably goes down as the best speaker we've ever had, a guy named Bobby Krim, speaker for 8 years. And one of his basic tenets of leadership was that when we tackled a hard issue, we had proportional bipartisan support for the result. Mm-hmm. We did not pass stuff, almost never, we sometimes did, but very rarely did we pass something on a party line vote, even though we had the votes to do it, mm-hmm. because he didn't believe that was the best way to govern. We had the advantage of working with a very progressive Republican governor in Bill Milliken during mm-hmm. that time, mm-hmm. who felt the same way, but we could work in harmony because Krim recognized that ultimately our self-government process is a function of compromise and accommodation of multiple points of view mm-hmm. rather than exercising power to get your way.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the system can allow for that,
right.
though. And so we never want to be dependent on one or two or 10 people's good nature. It should be a system.
Right.
And that was back before computers made gerrymandering so effective. Well, we didn't have computers then. Well, not sure how old I am.
Gerrymandering has been effective for a long time. I mean, you know, you talked about before how it was used literally in the first elections after the Constitution
was
ratified. Well, it was crude, but then, I mean, the term gerrymandering was coined only 24 years after the Constitution was ratified in 1812. It was coined in 1812, 24 years after the Constitution was ratified, and it was quite effective in that election. It actually did exactly what they wanted it to do in 1812. And it's been used many, many times since then. It's really a systemic problem. It's not something that we're going to solve with one patch. We have a whole system that we have to think about. How do we transform that system into something that's a democracy, actually, instead of something that's really designed to be a plutocratic oligarchy, a rule by the wealthy few. It's designed that way. It's provided that kind of rule for the entire run of American history, and to be able to change that, there's a lot of work to be done.
Well, my belief is that the next step, and this is my personal belief.
Yeah.
Is the next two steps are probably one which will be fairly easy, will be improving sunshine in government, open mm-hmm. meetings, freedom of information, mm-hmm. Financial disclosure. Mm-hmm. But the big one's going to be campaign finance reform. Without that, mm-hmm. We're screwed.
And Citizens mm-hmm. United. I completely agree. And that's one of the things I like most about Prop 2 mm-hmm. is the transparency. You can just tell that it has been clearly designed to be as transparent as possible. And that's part of what we just said. You never want to depend on people's good nature.
Right.
We want to see it. We want to depend on people watching the process and making sure that that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I agree completely with Walt. I mean, campaign finance, that's yeah. the next huge step. But I mean, there's also so many different approaches to take.
Sure.
That kind of affects every single approach, though.
Right.
But part of it is going to be achieving, as we did, reaching out to the people of the state and finding out if there's a consensus on the direction we should go with campaign finance reform, because there are a lot of ways to do it. You can have public mm-hmm. financing, mm-hmm. you can try to put caps on, you can do matching funds. There's a lot of different, even within the confines of Citizens United, there are ways to deal with it. Certainly disclosure of dark money would be a huge step forward,
mm-hmm.
which Ruth sure. Johnson tried to do until she was told by the DeVos family she couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That probably will be the next big battle, but I think it's going to be something that's going to take a long time to achieve because the people that got the money kind of like the power they got with it.
Well, and it's
right.
rooted in both parties because the
Absolutely.
Investors have invested in both parties.
Right. Absolutely. Right. People, you look at the campaigns now, the crazy amounts we were talking mm-hmm. before the taping.
Mm-hmm.
In this congressional cycle, over $2 billion is being spent by congressional candidates.
Right.
We could do a lot of good things with $2 billion. Sure. Heck, we could almost sure. we get started on Trump's wall.
And I mean, and all the way down to city council races. The last city council race I saw, the lead spender spent $65,000 for a city council seat.
Mayor's
that's
race.
A part-time job. So how do we justify this?
My opponent
this?
For county commissioner raised $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
25 grand. I think he got 1,800 votes. And he won overwhelmingly. He killed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not nagging, he's a good person, but that's a ridiculous amount of money.
Sure. Well,
so we got to wrap up here. Any final points on Prop 2?
Vote yes. Vote early, vote often, as we used to say in Chicago.
Yeah.
And vote yes on 3 as well.
Yeah.
3 is just as important. I've seen some internal polling, not from voters, not politicians, but from other sources.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of them are going to sail through with massive mm-hmm. majorities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think all 3 of the statewide props are great, Prop 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
I will say, not to get in the weeds here, on Prop 3, I don't like straight ticket voting. I think that's the opposite of ranked choice voting, or it's
don't vote straight ticket.
Yeah, so a couple of, so first of all, actually, next week on this show, we're talking about Prop 3. My point to you on the straight ticket voting is it's an option, and not having that option makes voting more difficult for people who would like to use it. And there are plenty of people that are happy to use it. And regardless of what, I mean, I've heard a lot of
we're
people.
We're both working as election judges.
And right.
The lines are going to be longer because we don't have straight ticket voting.
Sure, I will be tending those lines. However, that's allowing a party to say, pick all these candidates. So should there also be a bubble that says you can pick Liano Sharon's slate of candidates? It would save time. It would make it easier to pick.
Sure, Leonis can start his own political party.
Right, but but the straight ticket voting, it's giving too much power. I get it, though. I get why it helps. It cuts down on the lines, but it's still kind of voter apathy. It's saying, I don't really care about finding out who's representing me. I'm just going to trust
I voted a straight ticket, party. And it took me 10 times as long.
Wait a minute, because I want to. What you just said there, let me disagree with you a bit about that, because I've heard this argument before. So here's my problem with the argument that you're making. The problem is that what you're saying is you want to police how people make their decisions, and I don't think that we can do that. I think that there are some people that are going to be interested in figuring out all of that, and I think that there are going to be some people that are not going to be. And I think if we say, hey, we're going to make the people that don't want to do all of that research, we're going to make it more difficult for them to vote, I think a lot of them are not going to do it anyway.
My argument or response to that would be, you can still go in there, and it says Democrat, Republic, mm-hmm. Green Party, Libertarian. You can go in there, and you can just check off every Republican or every Democrat. So we're not saying you can't vote straight ticket.
Right. So
we're
why
saying you
are
have to fill
harder?
In a couple more bubbles versus implying that, look, this is a normal thing to do, is to just pick all these pre-candidates for you, and there's going to be a process to decide how you can have that done. I don't think that that's a fair process. I think that that entrenches the two-party system or maybe a three-party. But you're not saying somebody can't vote all Republican or all Democrat. Right. And you're also not saying you have to research and know every single candidate. It doesn't take that long to fill in the bubbles next to every R or every D. Right. So that's my comeback to that. Secondly, as far as time goes, we have, it's for ADA, this really should probably go on the next topic, but...
Let's wrap that up here. We'll actually do a little bit of after show here in a second, but let's wrap it up for this session right now. I really appreciate Walt. Thanks for coming on. I hope that you'll come on again. We'll have some more discussion. I hope you'll stick with us for a couple of minutes afterwards, and we can keep this discussion going a little bit. And Steve as well. I really appreciate. I know that when you were coming on, you said you didn't know a whole lot about Prop 2 as in depth as you would like. But I really appreciate your questions. I think you asked some stuff that will help a lot of people get a better idea of what's
sure.
going on.
I learned a thing or two. It's been great.
So in summary, I would also say, vote yes on 2, vote yes on 3, vote yes on 1, and we will see you here again next week, where we'll talk about Prop 3.